papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project gives you a half hour of commentary and analysis on what's going on in the news media, some insights into newsroom decision-making, perhaps. And we thank you for joining us. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union. Here with my colleagues today, we have the producer of this program, David Gustina.
Here to make sure it stays at a half hour.
He'll cut anything he doesn't like, you know, that's his power. Here's Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio.
Well, who's in the newsroom?
Oh boy. Now you've left everything in Ray Graff's hands. We're in trouble.
That's all right. He'll complain anyway.
Welcome to a new media projector. First time today, Andrew Waite, columnist for the Daily Gazette of Schenectady.
Hooray. Thanks for having me. I'll try not to embarrass myself.
Please, yeah, do your best. Why don't you just, by the way, explain how you got here, where you've been in Schenectady for a few years now.
Yeah, that's a long story. But Albany native, was out west doing community newspapers and ended up coming back here during the pandemic when the publication I was working for in Seattle closed. And that's how it happened.
And being a metro columnist is what we call it in the newspaper business. It must be really fun. I mean, how many columns a week do you write?
Yeah, I do three roughly. It depends on if there's a bigger investigation we're doing. But yeah, super fun. The challenge is absolutely finding, there's so much material, but what do you home in on that week? But
and I would think your job is to give opinion at a certain level, but you can't just rant, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we do have everything based in solid reporting, and that's a big piece of my role is to also dig in on some of the investigations that other people just don't have the time day to day to do. And so it's a bit of a blended role, actually. And part of that is the reality of short staffing of local newspapers. I can't just be riffing on what a city council is talking about. I have to do my own reporting and find unique stories, too. So
right. So what we have just seen in the capital region of New York is a really interesting visitation, let's say, by the national media. A spotlight was here because of the great basketball games being played in the women's NCAA tournament. And a lot of news came out of that. Not just the commentator dissing the capital region. There's nothing to do here. What do you think about this notion that there's nothing to do in Albany?
Rebecca Lobo faced the backlash, and all I can say about that, this is Ian, and I was at a lot of the games. She's a UConn great, a Hall of Famer, who was born in Hartford, which is a city that's very similar to Albany, and made her name in basketball in Storrs, Connecticut. So I think a lot of people had their hackles up when they heard on the national broadcast, hey, there's nothing to do in Albany, which was a cheap shot, and it's played out over several days. The New York Post went so far as to quote William Kennedy on whether there's anything to do in Albany. I would say there's no such thing as bad publicity. Having reported a lot on what it took to get these games back here, that was effectively a two-decade process for MVP Arena, the Albany County-owned arena, to host two women's basketball regionals with the biggest stars in the game. It involved getting a new convention center. There are so many people who worked so hard to put that four-day event on, and you could understand why people were a little offended by it. Albany was the center of the sports universe last week. There's no question about it. You had the top stars of the game and the highest watched women's college basketball game of all time. And guess what, folks? We knew how to measure the court, unlike Portland, Oregon.
And Ted Lasso showed up to our.
That's right.
There we go. But yet, I talked to a business leader yesterday who said, you know what? She was right. He said, actually, that was a bit of truth-telling, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And the energy inside the arena Monday night was electric, and you stepped outside of MVP Arena and it just evaporated. It wasn't there. And Jeff Buell, Redburn Development, he had a commentary about it that was essentially saying, we need to accept what's true here and we need to be able to vote and put our money where our mouth is if we really want to see change.
Oh. Is that true? Wait. Is that true? Because the mayor tweeted that there's about five different things going on in between there and the stadium she could have pointed out. And a lot of people talked about other things that could be done. But, you know, Bambi's mom said, if you don't got nothing nice to say, don't say nothing at all.
Did Bambi's mom say that? I thought she said, watch out for the men.
You know what? You stop it. Now, here's what the New York Times said, because they did a story on Rebecca Lobo's comments. And so there they are saying what she said bad about Albany, but Claire Fahey couldn't resist herself at the end. With the tournament now in Albany's rearview mirror, the city can turn its attention to a more pressing matter, a mysterious odor plaguing its north side, described by the New York Post as a urine-flatulence combination stench, end quote. An investigation is underway. Can't you just hear her laughing? Not only does Albany have nothing to do, they stink there, too. From the New York Times, of all places. Have they been into the New York subways?
I think that's exactly right. And if you listen to Lobo's comments, it obviously was a joke. It came in the moment, and it stung because it's true. That New York Times piece was very much trying to be in on the joke. This is our capital that we cover as the New York Times. We get to make fun of Albany too, and that kicker, I see that as that was the tone of the piece. I mean, it dredged up Times Union past covering of people dunking on Albany, and it was just a continuation of the New York Times, of everyone else being in on the joke. Everyone was in on it except Kathy Sheehan and other Albany officials.
I get it. Lighten up, David. But what about journalists as a part of the story, making a comment, inserting themselves into their own journalism? What about that, guys? Are we supposed to do that as a journalist?
Well, I think you want these days, we've talked about this a little bit, not the view from nowhere, that is this notion of objectivity, being so cool in your reporting that you don't really have any life in it. That's one of the reasons why there exists the job of Metro columnist, like what Andrew does, because there was such cold, heartless reporting. So putting a little bit of stuff into it with that New York Times stuff, yeah, it's offensive, I guess, but it's also true. It's just that the way she juxtaposed it was kind of...
But there are multiple truths in any city. It's the ones that you choose to highlight, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because we'd highlight the Statue of Liberty in New York.
Yeah. You know, my wife's first job out of college was at the New York Times, and her job title was copy boy. You can imagine how much my wife, the feminist, loved that. But one of her tasks was at 22 to help the New York Times reporters in the State Capitol Bureau get out of Albany as soon as the legislative day ended. You know, get me a flight out of here, because the Times reporters never wanted to be here. Less parochially, though, the news that came out of Albany began, of course, with Kim Mulkey, the legendary LSU coach, legendary basketball coach before she was at LSU, sort of preemptively attacking what was going to be a Washington Post profile of her and saying that it was going to be absolutely outrageous that there was a hit piece being done. It was inappropriate at best, wouldn't you think, Ian?
I thought it was so interesting to watch it play out as kind of a microcosm of the way news reporting has been looked at in this country in the past decade or so. You attack the story comes out, you act like you're above the story. Meantime, you benefit from the publicity of the story. So the week before getting to Albany, Kim Mulkey, unbidden, announces a story is coming out about me in the Washington Post, and it's going to be so terrible that I'm going to sue the newspaper. The story doesn't come out for a few days. LSU women's basketball comes to Albany. And if you've never seen Kim Mulkey before, she's a very flashy, hugely successful coach. She makes more than $3 million a year, and she coaches the then defending national champions. They were eventually knocked out by Iowa. Meantime, every question waiting for the story to come out is, have you heard anything more about the story that you announced was coming? The Washington Post didn't say a word in between her first press conference and then the arrival in Albany. Finally, on the second day that LSU is mandated to appear before the press, the Washington Post feature comes out that morning. Everyone has a chance to read it except Kim Mulkey, who says on ESPN, the timing is very suspicious, but I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. Wins the game, comes to the post game. In that time, every reporter in Albany, which is 100 people, they've all read the Washington Post story. Kim Mulkey has not read it yet.
She says.
And I think I believe her because it did come out while they were already dressed for the games. And then the truth is, rising above all the back and forth about whether it was a hit piece or not, It's not a totally flattering profile, but it's not a hit piece in any way.
Yeah, very nuanced, and the fact that the reporter talked to her father, estranged father, is part of what angered her, but that also just tells a lot about who Kim Mulkey is, what her upbringing was like, what her childhood was like, and holding on to grudges. It was very much a fully fleshed out profile that essentially showed why she would be so upset about it. That was what some of the commentary was coming out of it.
Some people are under the misconception that a profile is only talking to you. That's not what it's about. You are not who you are in isolation. You are who you are in relationship to others. That's why we go around and talk to other people in your life. And as Ian points out, she made a much bigger deal out of it, basically, than she should have, because we were learning more about who she was. She was the one that clearly showed she has a problem with confronting her past.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. She is the one who, by the way, has previously brought up her family.
Yes.
And it's like a politician who touts their children on the stump and then is upset when reporters write about their children. You can't play with both a sword and a shield and use your kids as both. And to attack a reporter as sleazy as she did for asking questions, to say that it's a hit piece before it's even been printed is inappropriate. By the way, one of the things that I admire is the fact that the Washington Post newsroom had the discipline to not shoot back, to actually remain silent and let the journalism speak for itself.
Was part of her anger coming because of what the LA Times columnist had written?
Well, that also came out in the later press conference. And I think she has a much more meritorious criticism for that piece.
Absolutely. LA Times veteran columnist Ben Bulk had a column where, in talking about the LSU-UCLA game, he referred to the LSU team as dirty debutantes and villains, whereas the Bruins, and I guess it's, of course, the hometown team for the LA Times, he referred to them as milk and cookies. Now, this is not only parochialism, but it seems racist, doesn't it?
I think this was the major kind of unspoken thing at the arena over the past week, because you had Iowa's Caitlin Clark, who is the number one star in the sport and happens to be white. And there's been a narrative ever since LSU and Iowa played the year before about sort of LSU being villainous. They have their stars, including African-American women like Angel Reese, and Iowa's Caitlin Clark, who lost last year's championship game, being sort of the great white hope, you know? And then they were on this collision course to play again. And meantime, this LA Times story gets thrown in there, and it makes the reporter look terrible.
Right, and the dirty debutantes, if you, as Kim Mulkey's told her players, go ahead and Google it and see what you find. It sent you to a porn movie.
Right. Now, the columnist apologized. He said, failed miserably in my choice of words, tried to be clever in my phrasing about one team's attitude using alliteration while not understanding the deeply offensive connotations or associations. You know, I write a weekly column. I understand the desire to sound clever and to use words that have a ring to them.
Yeah.
I can understand, but that doesn't excuse unintentional racism. He needed to do a better job, right?
Yeah, you have to cut your darlings. Yeah. You might like how it sounds, but you have to know what it might mean and what the implications are. Some of this is also the elevation of college women's basketball, and inherently we're talking about a sport played by 18 to 22-year-old women, and as that is part of the national consciousness and being written about in the way that sports are written about at the national level, where you do have kind of clean-cut narratives that then end up playing out. I mean, Bill Belichick was the famous villain of the NFL. This sort of stuff is how sports are often written about, and it is, I think, complicated and going to be very important going forward for journalists who are covering this to sort of decide how are things framed, what level of nuance is going to be used in framing these narratives, because there is some legitimacy to writing about sports in a way where it's good versus evil or whatever a narrative that fans can connect to. But we also have to remember that we're talking about 18 to 22-year-old women.
Some of whom are becoming multimillionaires.
Fair.
So do we treat them differently because they're younger?
Well, do we? That's interesting, because in this realm, they're suddenly catapulted into the adult world. How do you treat them? It's not quite the same thing as the Little League World Series. You know, we're not in Williamsport.
But and you could argue they're not fully developed adults either.
Well, and also name, image, and likeness is very different than someone getting a salary to play a professional sport. So I think the argument could still be on the men's side, too. These are not professional athletes. They can now be compensated, and that's a great thing. thing, but they should be written about. There should be an extra level of care, I think, when you are writing
about
it.
There you go. Yeah. An extra level of care. I think that people who look at journalism from the outside don't understand the nuance of the way we need to operate. When we talk about, for example, in the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists, the phrase is minimize harm. It isn't the same as the Hippocratic Oath, which says first do no harm. It is to say, consistent with your truth-telling responsibility, try to shape your journalism so that you minimize the harm that that truth-telling may cause. So, and that's especially important when you're dealing with 18 to 22-year-olds, or if they've been held back, you know, maybe longer.
Everyone got that extra COVID year of eligibility.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to say that. I thought, you know, Angel Reese was in the eye of the hurricane and really acquitted herself well, I thought. These press availabilities, people might not know this, but for the NCAA tournament, there are mandated times when the coach and the players have to meet the reporters and the locker room is open to the press. And it's a lot of eyeballs, cameras, notebooks, all trained on people who are going to perform or not on the highest stage. And I agree with Andrew. You know, this is something I didn't understand so much when I was closer to their age, is that they're 19. If they make a stupid play, you know, the whole country is going to tear them down. And that is something to keep in mind as a reporter.
Absolutely is. And not replicating, that is not repeating some of the criticism, I think, is part of it. You don't just get a man on the street saying, well, you know, Angel Reese deserves shade or attacking these people. I think you really have to be thoughtful about even what you include in the story, how you build a story when you're dealing with young people, even if they are famous in this case. Even if Angel Reese, you know, announced that she was entering the draft via a fashion shoot in Vogue magazine, which is kind of classy, meaning she had made the decision in advance and she did the full interview and the photo shoot and everything. And then it was published just a few days ago. So that's kind of a classy, grown-up way to handle something for such a young person. One more thing, by the way, on sports. And by the way, since this is the first show in many years when it's been just a bunch of guys in the room here, that's not why we're talking about sports. It's because it was the biggest story in our community recently.
And all of our women participants currently are unavailable.
Okay. Anyway, the question, though, is about investigative reporting in sports, which is an important element of it because so much of sports coverage these days is actually financed by the teams themselves. As general interest newsrooms have diminished in size due to the financial changes wrought by the digital age, we find that a lot of the day-to-day coverage comes from people who are actually paid by the teams themselves, which makes it very hard to get the kind of investigative reporting that an industry that accounts for 2% of the global economy, 2% of global GDP is sports. That's actually a humongous industry. Much of it taxpayers supported by either the tax breaks provided to the NFL, a not-for-profit, or tax breaks provided by stadiums built by taxpayers. So the problem is, where does that reporting come from these days? How do you get it?
You steal it from your newsroom right now. If it's big enough, just take Shohei Ohtani, right? I mean, that investigation needs to be done, and an in-depth investigation needs to be done there. And it's probably not going to be done by a lot of sports journalists. It's going to be given over to the investigative teams of newspapers. And you were citing this article that, you know, even HBO Sports, which had a great investigative show with Brian Gumbel, is now gone. We're losing a lot of this. So you do need independent investigation in sports because there are a lot of issues. Sports is not immune from the issues of society, and people pay attention to sports, so it's a good place to be doing investigative journalism.
Mm-hmm. By the way, did that program end because Bryant Gumbel decided to retire, or was that financially? I don't know the answer to that
question. The explanation he gave was that he didn't want to sign another 2 or 3 year contract at this age. So
yeah,
if you take him at his word, it's because he retired.
By the way, speaking of sports, have you seen Kevin Baker's book, The History of Baseball in New York City? It's just terrific. It's a great book. I mean, Kevin's a friend of mine, but it's a great book. Joe Donahue interviewed him here, and he's all over the place on the media. But what's it called? The Rise of Baseball in the City or something like that. It's a history of baseball combined with the history of the Society of New York. And it's fascinating, and it shows you what great literature still comes out of sports. No wonder some of the greatest writers have begun as sports writers. There's just great drama, and it really does make a difference. The Media Project, I'm Rex Smith, here with David Gustina, our producer, in front of the microphone this time, Ian Pickus, the news director at Northeast Public Radio, and Andrew Waite, columnist for the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. You know, by the way, let's give people, I pulled down some statistics that were just released, just to give our listeners a sense of how the world has changed. The new circulation numbers have just been released. We're talking about print. How many
should we
people...
get taps ready?
Yeah, please. Because let's just say this, the sixth largest newspaper, so the largest newspaper in the country is in print, is the Wall Street Journal. Second is the New York Times. It's the opposite of that in digital, because the New York Times has 10.9 million digital subscribers. But in print, the number six newspaper, the LA Times, has the same circulation that the Times Union had when I became the managing editor there. And the Times Union at that time was the 100th largest newspaper. Now the LA Times is number six. Number 15, San Francisco Chronicle, is the size that the Schenectady Gazette was back there at the turn of this century, wow, at the beginning of the 21st century. The San Francisco Chronicle is the size of the Gazette. And the New York Daily News, which once had 6 million print readers, it was the biggest newspaper in the country, is the size that the Troy Record was when I became the editor of that paper a few years ago. So, yes, I'm
weren't you
old.
The editor and the reporter and the business
and the copy boy?
And that. We had a newsroom of 38. I think it's now 5. But it just is, print is vanishing. And so, you know, I get upset because I think the print papers generally just look awful these days. But who cares? Because when people tell me, oh, I still read the newspaper in print, I say, why?
Well, isn't that it? Don't we need to give up the ghost? So many listeners write to us, stop talking about the newspaper. The newspaper is not anymore. No, you know, that's going bye-bye. And, you know, the truth is, those brands, though, those big brands like the New York Times and the LA Times, they're surviving. They're getting more subscribers. The issue is, we got to pay for the journalism.
Well, and for local newspapers, the cash cow continues to be the print subscriptions. That's certainly the case at the Gazette, and we've been slow to move over with rolling out a digital product that's worth looking at, and it's because we still make our money from print subscribers who are getting
amazing
older by the day. And
you have to read the Gazette if you want to know what's going on in Schenectady. That's the thing. It is still a robust news report, unlike what's going on with Gannett, which is just tragic. Since Gannett, which was once a mighty chain, is still the largest chain, but that hedge fund that owns it is hollowing out the newsrooms everywhere.
I'd like to know how newspapers and their subscriptions compare in the Northeast to other parts of the country. I wonder if we're stronger here. Do you have any numbers on that?
I think being in the capital, though, you have inherently people who are paying closer attention than they might be elsewhere. So I think the capital region, for sure. But I mean, what's interesting is the Gazette is buying new titles. The Times Union is trying to expand or has expanded down south. And so we talk about eating up other smaller publications. That's almost happening that's happening in our region, too. And what are going to be the implications of that? Is the Gazette going to staff properly in these places and the same sort of thing? And then all of a sudden, right, we are gobbling up local newspapers, and it's local newspapers eating their own.
So one of the things that, David, you put before us as the producer of this program, one of the things that David does is he suggests some content.
Feel free, listeners, by the way, to send it along at media@wmc.org.
Yes, media@wmc.org. We're very happy to hear from you. You suggested that we talk about an editorial in the New York Daily News about the purposeless primary, was the headline, urging people not to bother to vote in the New York primaries. What do you think about that?
I think it's a dumb move, and I read the whole thing, and I understand their arguments about no contest in the primary and the amount of money the government's going to spend to hold the primary. But we should not be educating people not to vote. We should certainly be saying all that they said in that editorial. What I'm saying is that is not a reason to now give people reason not to vote. They have enough in their minds already. Turnout in our elections is abysmal. We're worried about our democracy right now. And you're going to go along with the cynicism of not voting? I think it's a dumb move.
The other thing is that even if Biden and Trump have it locked up, there is this uncommitted or leaving blank, which is providing a statement to the Biden campaign that I think was worthwhile to see what that level would be in New York. And I think it was 12% or something. So there was something to be learned from it.
Yeah. Well, the question of what newspapers actually say on the editorial page is one that has been long debated. The Gazette for some years never endorsed candidates. and candidate endorsements have always been problematic for editorial boards, because then the sense is that, well, the newsroom is actually biasing its coverage to follow the editorial boards. But I always felt as an editor that we have access to these candidates that other people don't have, and I justified taking a position. I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not, frankly. I think that we should. I think that we have access to things. I don't know that it matters at all to whether there's actually a newspaper endorsement or not.
I'll tell you, when the Gazette endorsed Stefanik, that brought a lot of conversation one way or the other. And going forward, whether or not it had to do with the Stefanik endorsement, the Gazette has made the decision not to be endorsing candidates this time around. I'm not on the editorial board, just for the record.
It's okay. We're reading between the lines.
Yeah, I think so. Wow, very interesting. Finally today, we just need to make note of the fact that reporting is not without impact and not without risk. We're not only talking about the 90-plus journalists who have died in the Gaza conflict, which is tragic. We're talking about the arrest of Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal, now more than a year in custody. And Russia is rounding up more journalists and locking them up. It is not just there, but that's where it is most visible. And you know that the way that despots stay in power is by keeping people ignorant, which I think is part of what is on the mind of Vladimir Putin.
By the way, is it Gershkovich or Gershkovich or Gershkovich? I've heard it a number of different ways.
I'm a print guy.
Apparently.
I don't know this stuff. And with that, we have to say we're done with the program for today.
What?
And, I'm very sorry about that. Ian Pickus and David Gustina and Andrew Waite and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to you for joining us. And we hope you come back again next week on The Media Project.
But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know
the Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Substack columnist of the Upstate American, Rex Smith. Barbara Lombardo, the former editor of the Saratogian and a journalism professor at the University at Albany. Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. And WAMC news director Ian Pickus. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.